about Alexei. If so, you're right on target. In fact, the above episode is entirely about me, for it was I who wrote Alexei's essay. Okay, shame on me. In my defense, I should point out that I would normally no sooner write Alexei's essays than take a foot to the chin for him in his kung fu class. But Alexei had come to me for a critique of his work, and as usual presented his request late on the night before the paper was due. I told him I'd get back to him. Proceeding to read it on the computer, I first made a couple of minor changes. Nothing worth bothering to note. Then, being a relentless rewriter, I gradually found myself sucked in, rearranging this and rewriting that, and before I finished, not only had he fallen asleep, but I had made the essay my own. The next morning, sheepishly admitting that I had neglected to perform a save as on the original, I told him to just go ahead and turn in my version. He handed me the graded paper with a few words of encouragement. "Not bad," he told me. "A 93 is really more of an A- than an A, but it was late, and I'm sure if you were more awake, you would have done better." I was not happy. First of all, it is unpleasant when a 15-year-old says the very words to you that you have previously said to him, and nevertheless you find his words inane. But beyond that, how could my material, the work of a person whom my mother, at least, thinks of as a professional writer, not make the grade in a high school English class? Apparently, I am not alone. Since then, I have been told of another writer who had a similar experience, except his daughter received a B. Apparently, the writer, with a PhD in English, writes well enough for Rolling Stone, Esquire, and the New York Times, but not for English 101. Alexei tried to comfort me with another story. Two of his friends, he said, once turned in identical essays. He thought that was stupid and they'd both be suspended, but not only did the overworked teacher not notice, she gave one of the essays a 90, an A, and the other a 79, a C. Sounds odd unless, like me, you've had the experience of staying up all night grading a tall stack of papers with Star Trek reruns playing in the background to break the monotony. Numbers always seem to carry the weight of authority. The thinking, at least subliminally, goes like this. If a teacher awards grades on a 100-point scale, those tiny distinctions must really mean something. But if 10 publishers could deem the manuscript for the first Harry Potter book unworthy of publication, how could poor Mrs. Finnegan, not her real name, distinguish so finely between essays as to award one a 92 and another a 93? If we accept that the quality of an essay is somehow definable, we must still recognize that a grade is not a description of an essay's degree of quality, but rather a measurement of it. And one of the most important ways randomness affects us is through its influence on measurement. In the case of the essay, the measurement apparatus was the teacher, and a teacher's assessment, like any measurement, is susceptible to random variance and error. Voting is also a kind of measurement. In that case, we are measuring not simply how many people support each candidate on election day, but how many care enough to take the trouble to vote. There are many sources of random error in this measurement. Some legitimate voters might find that their name is not on the rolls of registered voters. Others mistakenly vote for a candidate other than the one intended. And of course, there are errors in counting the votes. Some ballots are improperly accepted or rejected. Others are simply lost. In most elections, the sum of all these factors doesn't add up to enough to affect the outcome. But in close elections, it can. And then we usually go through one or more recounts, as if our second or third counting of the votes will be less affected by random errors than our first. In the 2004 governor's race in the state of Washington, for example, the Democratic candidate was eventually declared the winner, although the original tally had the Republican winning by 261 votes out of about 3 million. The original vote count was so close, state law required a recount. In that count, the Republican won again, but only by 42 votes. It is not known whether anyone thought it was a bad sign that the 219-vote difference between the first and second vote counts was several times larger than the new margin of victory. But the upshot was a third vote count, this one entirely by hand. The 42-vote victory amounted to an edge of just one vote out of each 70,000 cast. So, the hand-counting effort could be compared to asking 42 people to count from 1 to 70,000 and then hoping they averaged less than one mistake each. Not surprisingly, the result changed again. This time it favored the Democrat by 10 votes. That number was later changed to 129, then 700 newly discovered lost votes were included. Neither the vote counting process nor the voting process is perfect. If, for instance, owing to post office mistakes, 1 in 100 prospective voters didn't get the mailer with the location of the polling place, and 1 in 100 of those people did not vote because of it, in the Washington election, that would have amounted to 300 voters who would have voted but didn't because of government error. Elections, like all measurements, are imprecise, and so are the recounts. So when elections come out extremely close, perhaps we ought to accept them as is, or flip a coin, rather than conducting recount after recount. The imprecision of measurement became a major issue in the mid-18th century, when one of the primary occupations of those working in celestial physics and mathematics was the problem of reconciling Newton's laws with the observed motions of the moon and planets. One way to produce a single number from a set of discordant measurements is to take the average, or mean. It seems to have been young Isaac Newton who, in his optical investigations, first employed it for that purpose. But, as in many things, Newton was an anomaly. Most scientists in Newton's day, and in the following century, didn't take the mean. Instead, they chose the single golden number from among their measurements, the number they deemed mainly by hunch to be the most reliable result they had. That's because they regarded variation in measurement not as the inevitable byproduct of the measuring process, but as evidence of failure, with at times even moral consequences. In fact, they rarely published multiple measurements of the same quantity, feeling it would amount to the admission of a botched process and raise the issue of trust. But in the mid-18th century, the tide began to change. Calculating the gross motion of heavenly bodies, a series of nearly circular ellipses, is a simple task performed today by precocious high school students as music blares through their headphones. But to describe planetary motion in its finer points, taking into account not only the gravitational pull of the sun, but also that of the other planets and the deviation of the planets and the moon from a perfectly spherical shape, is even today a difficult problem. To accomplish that goal, complex and approximate mathematics had to be reconciled with imperfect observation and measurement. There was another reason why the late 18th century demanded a mathematical theory of measurement. Beginning in the 1780s, in France, a new mode of rigorous experimental physics had arisen. Before that period, physics consisted of two separate traditions. On the one hand, mathematical scientists investigated the precise consequences of Newton's theories of motion and gravity. On the other, a group sometimes described as experimental philosophers performed empirical investigations of electricity, magnetism, light, and heat. The experimental philosophers, often amateurs, were less focused on the rigorous methodology of science than were the mathematics-oriented researchers. And so a movement arose to reform and mathematize experimental physics. In it, Pierre-Simon de Laplace again played a major role. Laplace had become interested in physical science through the work of his fellow Frenchman, Antoine Laurent Lavoisier, considered the father of modern chemistry. Laplace and Lavoisier worked together for years, but Lavoisier did not prove as adept as Laplace at navigating the troubled times. To earn money to finance his many scientific experiments, he had become a member of a privileged private association of state-protected tax collectors. There is probably no time in history when having such a position would inspire your fellow citizens to invite you into their homes for a nice hot cup of gingerbread cappuccino. But when the French Revolution came, it proved an especially onerous credential. In 1794, Lavoisier was arrested with the rest of the association and quickly sentenced to death. Ever the dedicated scientist, he requested time to complete some of his research, so that it would be available to posterity. To that, the presiding judge famously replied, "The Republic has no need of scientists." The father of modern chemistry was promptly beheaded, his body tossed into a mass grave. He had reportedly instructed his assistant to count the number of words his severed head would attempt to mouth. Laplace's and Lavoisier's work, along with that of a few others, especially the French physicist Charles-Augustin de Coulomb, who experimented on electricity and magnetism, transformed experimental physics. Their work also contributed to the development in the 1790s of a new rational system of units, the metric system, to replace the disparate systems that had impeded science and were a frequent cause of dispute among merchants. Developed by a group appointed by Louis XVI, the metric system was adopted by the revolutionary government after Louis's downfall. Lavoisier, ironically, had been one of the group's members. The demands of both astronomy and experimental physics meant that a great part of the mathematician's task in the late 18th and early 19th centuries was understanding and quantifying random error. Those efforts led to a new field, mathematical statistics, which provides a set of tools for the interpretation of the data that arise from observation and experimentation. Statisticians sometimes view the growth of modern science as revolving around that development, the creation of a theory of measurement. But statistics also provides tools to address real-world issues, such as the effectiveness of drugs or the popularity of politicians, so a proper understanding of statistical reasoning is as useful in everyday life as it is in science. It is one of those contradictions of life that although measurement always carries uncertainty, the uncertainty in measurement is rarely discussed when measurements are quoted. If a fastidious traffic cop tells the judge her radar gun clocked you going 39 in a 35-mile-per-hour zone, the ticket will usually stick despite the fact that readings from radar guns often vary by several miles per hour. And though many students, along with their parents, would jump off the roof if doing so would raise their 598 on a math SAT to 625, few educators talk about the studies showing that if you want to gain 30 points, there's a good chance you can do it simply by taking the test a couple more times. Sometimes meaningless distinctions even make the news. One recent August, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the unemployment rate stood at 4.7%. In July, the Bureau had reported the rate at 4.8%. The change prompted headlines like this one in the New York Times. Jobs and wages increased modestly last month. But as Gene Epstein, the economics editor of Barron's, put it, merely because the number has changed, it doesn't necessarily mean that a thing itself has changed. For example, any time the unemployment rate moves by a tenth of a percentage point, that is a change that is so small, there is no way to tell whether there really was a change. In other words, if the Bureau of Labor Statistics measures the unemployment rate in August and then repeats its measurement an hour later, by random error alone, there is a good chance that the second measurement will differ from the first by at least a tenth of a percentage point. Would the New York Times then run the headline, "Jobs and Wages Increased Modestly by 2 p.m.? The uncertainty in measurement is even more problematic when the quantity being measured is subjective. Like Alexei's English class essay. For instance, a group of researchers at Clarion University of Pennsylvania collected 120 term papers and treated them with a degree of scrutiny you can be certain your own child's work will never receive. Each term paper was scored independently by 8 faculty members. The resulting grades on a scale from A to F sometimes varied by 2 or more grades. On average, they differed by nearly 1 grade. Since a student's future often depends on such judgments, the imprecision is unfortunate. Yet it is understandable given that, in their approach and philosophy, the professors in any given college department often run the gamut from Karl Marx to Groucho Marx. But what if we control for that? That is, if the graders are given and instructed to follow a certain fixed grading criteria. A researcher at Iowa State University presented about 100 students' essays to a group of doctoral students in rhetoric and professional communication, whom he had trained extensively according to such criteria. 2 independent assessors graded each essay on a scale of 1 to 4. When the scores were compared, the assessors agreed in only about half the cases. Similar results were found by the University of Texas in an analysis of its scores on college entrance essays. Even the venerable College Board expects only that, when assessed by 2 raters, 92% of all scored essays will receive ratings within plus or minus 1 point of each other on the 6-point SAT essay scale. Another subjective measurement that is given more credence than it warrants is the rating of wines. Back in the 1970s, the wine business was a sleepy enterprise, growing but mainly in the sales of low-grade jug wines. Then, in 1978, an event often credited with the rapid growth of that industry occurred. A lawyer turned self-proclaimed wine critic, Robert M. Parker Jr., decided that, in addition to his reviews, he would rate wines numerically on a 100-point scale. Over the years, most other wine publications followed suit. Today, annual wine sales in the United States exceed $20 billion, and millions of wine aficionados won't lay their money on the counter without first looking to a wine's rating to support their choice. So when Wine Spectator awarded, say, the 2004 Valentin Bianchi Argentine Cabernet Sauvignon a 90 rather than an 89, that single extra point translated into a huge difference in Valentin Bianchi's sales. In fact, if you look at your local wine shop, you'll find that the sale and bargain wines, owing to their lesser appeal, are often the wines rated in the high 80s. But what are the chances that the 2004 Valentin Bianchi Argentine Cabernet that received a 90 would have received an 89 if the rating process had been repeated, say, an hour later? In his 1890 book, The Principles of Psychology, William James suggested that wine expertise could extend to the ability to judge whether a sample of Madeira came from the top or the bottom of a bottle. In the wine tastings that I've attended over the years, I've noticed that if the bearded fellow to my left mutters, a great nose, the wine smells good, others certainly might chime in their agreement. But if you make your notes independently and without discussion, you often find that the bearded fellow wrote, great nose, and the guy with the shaved head scribbled, no nose, and the blonde woman with the perm wrote, interesting nose with hints of parsley and freshly tanned leather. From the theoretical viewpoint, there are many reasons to question the significance of wine ratings. For one thing, taste perception depends on a complex interaction between taste and olfactory stimulation. Strictly speaking, the sense of taste comes from 5 types of receptor cells on the tongue: salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. The last responds to certain amino acid compounds, prevalent, for example, in soy sauce. But if that were all